Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Wednesday. We are live. We have so much to talk about, an action-packed day, price action in almost every single market. Soon, we'll be joined up by a pre-recorded message from our CEO and co-founder, Raoul Pal, with our senior editor, Ash Bennington. But first, I'm here hosting the show with Weston Nakamura. Weston, what did you make of this price action where almost every single asset class money flooded out instead of going in? Almost everything was in the red, most conspicuously crypto. What did you make? Just walk us through how you saw the day in terms of the different asset classes.
It was certainly a wild day. I'll get to crypto, in a minute. But from the equity market, we saw this pretty sharp sell-off going into cash open in the U.S. following, a weak market in Asia as well as in Europe. This is all following, crypto sell-off and all that. And then you actually ended the day not as bad as it was. We actually saw the SOX index, the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index, up about 1.25%. Commodities got hit. Crude got hit pretty hard across the board. We had a little bit of a bid in gold that seems to have petered out a little bit as well. For the most part, it just seemed like just a ton of, scrambling around cross asset, not really, looking at each other, not really knowing what to make of it. And then you have tech and actually ending up in the green.
Yeah, globally, equities were very weak today. As you said, Asian stocks opened in the red, and that we saw that in Europe as well. The NASDAQ really led the way down, starting, as you said, at cash open 9:30 in the morning, down about 2%, but it ended the day almost flat on the day. So it really recovered those losses. Weston, this is a really topsy-turvy market. Just break us down how you saw the interplay between those plummeting equity markets, or not plummeting, but swooning, let's say, and the absolutely stunning eye-popping crash in crypto. It's really baffling. Just walk us through that.
Yeah, just to let's sum it up really quick. First of all, what I forgot to mention too was that today was May VIX futures expiry at the open as well. So that certainly didn't help in terms of adding to the confusion. But around 9:15 a.m. Eastern or so, you saw this massive like $300 million notional worth of Bitcoin futures that just hit the bid, for which there was no bid until about 24% lower. And you saw this broad-based indiscriminate crypto crash that pulled down risk assets. You saw a inverse bid in gold at that time. And again, that was just a very, very short-lived sort of an inverse move. That seemed to have kind of scared people, thinking like, okay, crypto is becomes institutional to the point where it's actually pulling down traditional assets, or it's impacting traditional assets. And now we're looking at, the markets that are basically clawing their way back to flat, and, as if it were just another day. If you actually looked at the crypto market from midnight EST to now, they're basically flat, so you wouldn't have noticed any of this.
Yeah, it really is shocking how much we've recovered. Just for people at home who aren't following the crypto markets, Bitcoin began the day, let's say, at about 45,000, and it briefly flirted with 30,000. So really hundreds of billions of dollars incinerated in a few hours, if not actually a few minutes, as you said, at around 9 a.m. this morning. Ethereum also dipping below 2,000. A few days ago, that was unthinkable. Now it's at about 2,700,
2,800. Ethereum had a down 40% move at one point on intraday.
So yeah, it really is shocking. So Our CEO and co-founder, Rao, wanted to help people make sense of this. As a lot of people know, he's been very constructive on this space, and this is can be quite a little bit of a scary time. So he couldn't actually join us on the Daily Briefing Live. He wanted to, but he pre-recorded a dispatch that he filmed with Ash, just so people can sort of wrap their heads around this sell-off and then this quite surprising recovery. So with that, let's go to Rao's pre-recorded message with Ash Bennington.
It's 2:30 p.m. on the East Coast. Volatility in digital asset markets today. I'm joined by CEO and co-founder Rao Pal. Rao, what's happening? What does it mean? And how does it influence your larger thesis?
I mean, it's been a hell of a market. Really, there's no real news. There's a bit of news out of China that banks won't be able to onboard people into crypto. And there's been a Elon Musk messing around with the market, but there's nothing really. The Bitcoin price had been topping for a while, just felt heavy, and it had been underperforming Ether, as we know. And then it started over the weekend and spilled down into a total meltdown. And a feature of these crypto markets is excessive leverage, particularly in Asia. So if you see where a lot of the liquidations happen, they happen on the Asian exchanges, where Asian traders tend to use a lot more leverage than they do in the Western world. So as price action starts pushing lower, it starts liquidating lots and lots of positions. So that's really what we saw. We saw a massive liquidation. I mean, Ethereum saw a liquidation of the entire sharp up move that we saw. And it all came, you know, at one point today, when I was up this morning, Ethereum was down 42% on the day. Now, if that was the stock market, this would be one of the biggest, most scary crashes of all time. But this is the crypto market. This is the crypto market that is a 65 to 100 vol asset. And I've explained endlessly that you should always expect a 50% correction. If you get away for less, you should be happy. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had the 2017 bull run, as a great example, had something like 6 or 7 35% corrections. Now, the 50% correction that we've seen in Ethereum and Bitcoin is larger than most, but again, not unusual in a bull market, and particularly not in the kind of spike down volumes. This wasn't a crunching, disgusting, long grinding bear market. This was a panic liquidation. And that always leads me to, what do you do about this? What should you do? Well, the first rule, and I've explained it time and time again, is don't use leverage. So then if you didn't use leverage and you were in ETH this year, for example, you're still up 250%, even at the bottom of the sell-off. It doesn't matter that much because these things go up exponentially and they correct sharply, but they still are on this exponential rise. So you should be compensated by the returns for the risk that you're taking, i.e. a 50% pullback. And that seems to be the case. Both Bitcoin and Ethereum still remain up on the year, although, you know, Bitcoin's had more of a kind of topping pattern over a period of time. Has anything changed for me? Nothing. Where's the flow of funds? Well, interesting enough, the first movers in the institutional space are in. And we've actually been lacking, I've certainly been lacking the phone calls of, okay, I'm going to put capital to work today. The conversations I've been having with a lot of the bigger institutions is, yes, we've agreed we need to do this. We need to clear our paperwork with Fidelity or Coinbase or whoever it is. We need to start setting up accounts. We need to figure it out. We need to get our risk systems in place. So that wall of money that I refer to is still there. I got, I don't know, 5 phone calls from pretty famous investors today who are all like, well, I'm just buying the dip. One of them who's a good friend who's very well-known, very large hedge fund manager. I said, so what do you think about the sell-off? He went, his exact words were, why the fuck do I care? And the reason being is because people understand in this space, if your time horizon is multi-years, then you can't be overly concerned about the path that it takes. So what I want to do is go through some of the technical charts that give me comfort to show why I don't think it was that big an event, even though it felt terrible. So here's the basic chart of Bitcoin on a log chart. Remember, we need to use log charts in these assets because they're exponential assets. And here's the trend line, and Bitcoin beautifully kissed the trend line. So now you would say Bitcoin has gone back to trend and is now free to rise higher. I also love to use regression lines, which give you one and two standard deviations versus a trend. This is the regression of Bitcoin from the low in March. And what it did was actually it broke through it, but bounced back above the two standard deviations oversold. Bitcoin's about as oversold as it's ever been. It's certainly as oversold as it was in March. And if you were to be able to deploy capital in this market and you still believe in the long-term story, which I do, then this would be the time you'd be buying and not selling. And that's a typical feature of markets like this. You need to be buying over time, looking for these sell-offs to give you an advantage to add in. Ethereum was even more dramatic today. There was a huge liquidation as the entire bull run from April got unwound in one day. But if you can see the little tick on the right, I mean, it hit below 2,000 and it's currently at about 2,800. So, I mean, that's a 40% rise from the low, which alone would be a good year in the S&P. Now, it's still down significantly, about 20% today. But again, it bounced here off the 200-day moving average and also off its small trend line from the December low. And again, these are the kinds of signals that tell you that the market reached the oversold point and has probably finalized where it needed to go to on the downside to flush out the excessive leverage and the speculative hubris that sometimes builds up in assets like this. Don't forget, network effect assets are driven by behavior a lot of the time. And so human behavior tends to be quite volatile. So these assets are always volatile and tend to do stuff like this. Ethereum, with its regression channel on the log chart, actually got less oversold, only one standard deviation, and it's currently resting on its average trend line since the bull market started in March. So we got oversold first thing this morning, US hours, and we're now back to average line, and we should be again looking to base from here and start building a pattern where we can start rising. Another way of looking at it is, how oversold did it get? It got incredibly oversold that the RSI hit the equal lowest level that it's done since March. And those levels have always seen bounces. So again, this is the kind of area you'd be looking for, to looking to add on the dip. And my final killer chart for you is, here's the Bitcoin price now versus the Bitcoin price in the 2013 bull run. It is almost an exact fit. And that suggests that these kind of pullbacks, and if this pattern continues to repeat, there's no guarantee, then it's going to tell us that we've got the bulk of the rise ahead of us. Mm. At this point in 2013, it actually rose 10x. Now, could this correction last a bit longer? For sure. Could we reach a new low? For sure. But you can see the risk reward is balancing in the favor of this thing now basing and then rising over time. I'm not showing you the chart, but I've also got a chart of Ethereum versus the Bitcoin bull market of 2017. It's roughly the same thing. And these charts are telling us that something like 400,000 is the upside in Bitcoin and 20,000 plus in Ethereum. I think they may even be overshot in this bull market, but that's the size of the risk and the opportunity here. If there's a 10x upside and a 50% downside, well, that's a hell of a risk reward. So that's why markets like this, they're hard, they make everybody feel terrible, but they also shake out some of the bad, weak protocol coins, some of the bad DeFi projects. They shake out people who have taken too much leverage and shouldn't be doing it. And what it allows people who are patient capital is to accumulate at the right prices.
Yeah. You know, you point there to 2013. I was reading some analysis from Wrecked Capital looking at 2017, a series of retracements there in the 30 to 40% range. In fact, in 2017, during the bull market cycle, five major retracements that deep.
Yeah. So, Mike, I wanted to come on quickly just to say to everybody, because I know a lot of people follow my thought process on this, is I think this is normal. It's ugly. If you can take advantage of it and add, then I would be suggesting that might be a good thing to do. And again, it's a good lesson in why not to use leverage and just be calm, think of the long term, and carry on.
Ralph, final question for you. You mentioned time horizons. You've talked about your thesis. one more time, give us a sense of the time horizon you're looking at now and why that's significant here.
So I think if we look at the previous bull cycles in crypto, that after the halving occurs, they tend to go on for about 18 months. And that would take us into something like December to March of next year to complete the move. And that kind of makes sense to me. That's what the price structure on the charts looks like. It's the previous examples. So for the bulk of the sharp move, that's what I'm looking for, that time horizon. It could change because of institutional adoption. It could elongate. I think that's possible too. I don't think it's going to undershoot. And it probably may even overshoot in price because, let's say, ETFs, if they come. My overall thesis is much bigger. It's a 5 to 10 year bet that this space is going to go from $2 trillion to $200 trillion. That's the whole digital asset space. And that's 100x. So 50% volatility, I'll take that all day for 100x. That's a 500 to 1 risk reward. You don't get those ever.
Yeah. Raul, thanks for joining us. Thanks for providing that context. Thanks for watching, everyone. Stay safe out there.
Yeah, and take care, everybody. I understand it's been a bad day for many, but keep calm and carry on.
Wow. Bold words from Raul. Thank you, Raul, for sharing that message. Weston, Raul's making the case that if you believe in the long-term trend, this pullback, it's really not going to matter in the long term, and that he is adding on to dips. What do you make of this view, and what is your view?
Yeah, well, what he's saying is nothing has changed except the price. So if you're bullish and nothing has fundamentally changed about, if the reason that you're bullish has not changed, and the only thing that's changed is that the price has just fallen significantly, it may be a great time for you to go long. If not, you know, all else equal, because if not now, when? Right? So you can always, if it drops another 20%, you know, you can scale in. You don't have to just move, you know, your entire allocation in one clip. In fact, if you do that, you're just gambling at moments on time. But these sort of crashes historically are flash crashes, you know, and how many times are you going to say, oh, I wish it was at whatever it was, you know, 20% ago? You're getting that opportunity now. If nothing else changed, you know, your view shouldn't, if your view hasn't changed and nothing about the asset has fundamentally changed, except for the price, I mean, it would be almost irresponsible not to take advantage.
Yeah. I always think of the Warren Buffett quote that if you buy a house and then the next day someone offers you 40% less for that house, are you going to sell your house just because you got quoted a lower price? Likewise, if you're bullish on Bitcoin and it goes down 40%, you would probably be inclined to buy, not sell. So that's the key phrase. Nothing has changed. And as you say, that's exactly what Raul said. Weston, what did you make about Raul's point about the volatility in the asset class, where the volatility is from 65 to 100? Yeah, what did you make of that?
Okay, so he, you know, this is not just Raul. I heard this a few times being said throughout the day today. You know, this is a 70 vol asset, 80 vol, whatever it is. What that means is that this is what, forget what the volatility is. This is what freely trading markets look like. Okay, we haven't seen what freely traded markets look like for I don't know, a decade or so. This is what markets look like when you don't have global central banks artificially suppressing volatility, interventionist central banks buying every dip, putting a safety net under every single, you know, slight tremor or taper tantrum or whatever it may be. This is what happens. If you let free markets play out and there is value in the asset and others see there's value in the asset, then the asset will rebound itself, as you saw with Ethereum going down 40% and then basically rebounding right back. That is the free market put, if you will, not a Fed put. There's no Chairman Powell that needs to come out and announce something for you to put your capital to work. Free markets will do that. That was on display today. 70 vol assets don't exist except for here, and this is what 70 vol asset behaves like. And if there is, a value proposition behind it, you will see investors take advantage of it.
Definitely, as one of our colleagues here at Real Vision said to me today, Okay, volatility is one hell of a drug. And there are some people perhaps who want to launch a drug war. Some people just play devil's advocate, Weston, who would say, hey, we had this Wild West before the Federal Reserve. What we had was banking panics. We had deflation. We had banks issuing their own currency. You know, one thinks of this whole, Dave Portnoy launching SafeMoon, someone launching Cum Rocket, someone else launching, you know, all these coins new every day, perhaps would remind you of the Wild West of banking before the Federal Reserve. What would you say, Weston, to people who say, hey, you know, all this freedom comes at a cost and there's some real harm there?
Well, look, if you're talking about regulations and all that, I think that there's absolutely a place for proper regulations. They need to be smart, they need to be tailored, and they need to be, you know, and all that. I think that, you know, for that system, pre-Federal Reserve, when you're getting a financial crisis once every, few years, then fine. And, you know, when you need to have trust in banking systems, I get all of that. But what we're talking about now is this third mandate, and markets down, risk off, that is not markets broken. Markets broken is markets unconditionally higher. That's what markets broken is. So I would suggest that perhaps if you want to stick with your dual mandate, you stick with your dual mandate. If you want to have this third mandate that you've adopted where asset prices can never go down for a certain cohort of investors, just come out and say it, you know, like and as they have. And in that case, and if that's the case, there really is no real market anymore when you have a unlimited, non-economic, actor in the market, distorting prices, and furthermore, that other investors perceive them to be there, whether or not they're there. That is not a functioning market at all. What you saw today was functioning markets, even not functioning platforms, but functioning markets.
Yeah, let's get into those non-functioning platforms. So I've got an article in front of me today. Crypto investors fume as world's biggest platforms are disrupted. So Coinbase reportedly had partial outages, although they did later fix the issue. Binance, another exchange, temporarily disabled Ethereum withdrawals. So what do you make of these quite sizable dislocations and disturbances within the crypto market?
I think this is fantastic for the Robinhood IPO. Because they actually were okay today. So I checked Down Detector. Anyone doesn't know what that is, it's like $3 for a subscription for it. But you basically get anything that's down. It's not just like brokerage platforms, all that. It's anything. It's Amazon Web Services if that's down, and you can see people's complaints, and you could actually look at the geographic region in where there's like clusters of them. So what I saw was, When the crypto market just plummeted, around nine-ish, Eastern. All right, so Coinbase was down in the U.S. and in the EU. I'm based in Japan. I'm based in Tokyo. I have Coinbase accounts, and I probably shouldn't say, but I have U.S. accounts. I have Japan accounts. I could get into my Japan accounts. I could not get into Coinbase. So Binance, EU down. Asia and U.S. were okay. Kraken hit EU hard. U.S. was also affected, but not nearly as widespread. Gemini hit the U.S. and EU little. Point is, Asia bought that dip, especially on Ethereum. Ethereum right at 200,000 yen. You can look at the chart. It's right spot there because that was the only market, or that was the only region that was not affected by these delays, these, you know, whatever the hell that it is that they're doing, right? Both Coinbase and Kraken were saying reporting delays in, you know, Ethereum ERC-20 withdrawals and this and that, and then they also froze the leverage products, and so on top of all that, Fidelity goes down. So but I think that this is a wake-up call for these platforms to get their shit together, because just because the E-Trades, the Robin Hoods, the Schwabs and of the equity world are doing, you know, have outages, it doesn't make it okay. In fact, it makes it absolutely unacceptable, especially coming from the narrative or the marketing narrative of crypto, of how you are not, you know, you are you are free to transact, you are free to trade from anywhere in the world. You know, it's totally autonomous and this and that. And if you're really at the whim of, you know, these companies that are just hooked up to like AWS, Amazon Web Services, then I mean, it's kind of centralized IT, you know, so it's a risk to consider.
Yeah, most exchanges, I think, are, at least I've heard this, are hooked up to Amazon Web Services. So if there's a crash there, there's a crash on most crypto exchanges, which is, as you would imply, not exactly decentralized. Weston, you said that there was a strong bid from Asia on the dip. I'm also hearing from a few variety of sources that the institutional bid was really present today, that hedge funds were buying. I'm also hearing a few university endowments decided to pull the trigger on the lows today. So you really did see some strength there. Weston, I want to ask you, you said going back to Asia on the Ethereum 200,000 yen for Ethereum, that was really where you saw extreme support. That brings us to a point that I think is so important for people to understand, which is that crypto is denominated in almost every single currency worldwide, and it's also denominated in each other. So, you know, the oil, the vast majority of every barrel of oil is denominated in US dollars. So there's not a huge arbitrage between, like, you know, WTI in dollars versus WTI in the peso, let's say. But the Bitcoin to US dollar, that's a trade. Bitcoin to euro, Bitcoin to Japanese yen, Bitcoin to the Chinese yuan, to the Mexican peso, to everything. And then there's Bitcoin to Ethereum. There's Bitcoin to everything. There's Bitcoin to even, you know, cum rocket. So there's this huge arbitrage opportunities. And I think that's why a lot of institutional players are really excited about the space. But that also lends itself to the disruptions that we saw today, which for the average retail client is perhaps not great.
Yeah. So I was looking for at one point. So I look at BTC JPY, BTC USD. First of all, I say this all the time. So people on the exchange are sick of hearing this from me. But just as you said, Bitcoin is not a U.S. asset. Just like oil is not a U.S. asset, just like gold is not a U.S. asset. Now, those are denominated in USD. Yes, I understand that. Bitcoin is not denominated in USD. It's BTC fiat. And it's not an American asset. So people need to get that out of their head. And if you actually look at BTC JPY, you'll be a hell of a lot more, like, the levels will make a hell of a lot more sense. Like, they just move on round numbers. So 6 million yen, 5.5 million yen, 5.2 million yen, 5 million yen. If you look at the same exact charts, but you just denominated BTC JPY, you will see exact 100,000 yen increments in which they basically, you know, it will break a level, it'll pause, it'll break a level, it'll pause, it'll reverse, it'll hit, you know, 6 million resistance, 5 million resistance, so on and so forth. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, as you were saying, in terms of the ARB, there was a moment today where I was looking at it. So BTC JPY and BTC USD basically trade more or less the same exact percent. There was a 4.3% differential between BTC USD and BTC JPY today. And it's not like there was dollar yen that was trading, you know, that a 4.3% move either, right? So that would make sense, but that's not the case. There was just a lot of, we'll just call them inefficient markets, and a ton of ARB opportunities. Now, I obviously don't have the infrastructure to take advantage of that, but and that ARB closed up pretty quickly. But I've never seen spreads like that before. And I would say that's definitely much more of a function of the outages and the regional outages, and where things were working and where things were not, that caused a lot of that.
Yeah, and that is why there's so much opportunity in there for those relative value arbitrage plays that they're really not available in the traditional capital markets anymore. You know, now one thinks of the relative value plays. You buy some call on Delta Airlines and you short some future on American Airlines. I'm just making that up, by the way. And that's sort of thought, you know, you're picking pennies up in front of a steamroller, but in the crypto world, it's kind of like you're picking up nickels and dimes and quarters on a highway with no cars in sight. So, Weston, what I want to ask you is, in this Ethereum world, which is, sorry, just another point, which is, you know, you hear of some coins on some exchanges going for $100 and then other ones are going on $80. So it's, the word arbitrage is honestly not paying. It's just so simple. And, you know, those trades used to be in traditional capital markets. I actually think that Bernie Madoff, used to sort of be his bread and butter, but it got arbitraged away. And I've read that some people say that the reason Bernie Madoff became a fraud was because that arbitrage went away. But the arbitrage is alive and well in crypto.
Yeah, it's a good thing he's dead and not trading crypto.
That's for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, no. So I think that so arbs will close. They just will. Look, there are going to be lessons and takeaways from today that won't emerge, you know, right away. They might hit you sometime, you know, days from now. But that's another thing too, is that it shows actually what the lack of institutional presence. I mean, you hear so much about how much institutions have been adopting and getting into crypto and Bitcoin, especially as of late. And then to the point where, you know, like the Bank of America fund managers survey has like Bitcoin as the most overweight or the biggest like bubble asset class and all that, right? So it sounds like there's a lot of institutional money in there, and it seems like there is. The behavior is, you know, there's FX open at 7 a.m. or 6 a.m. you know, Japan time. There's like, you know, futures open. You start seeing moves at, you know, in crypto and all that kind of thing. You see more correlation with the assets. But these sort of spreads, like a 4% spread on BTC JPY versus BTC USD, that just shows that there's actually a lack of institutional firepower behind there. The HFT guys or the the ARBs and the high frequency and and that whole infrastructure is just not there yet. And I wouldn't expect it there to be, because we're not working on traditional rails, right? We're not working on the traditional legacy system of, settlement, trading, you know, execution, clearing, settling, allocations, and all that kind of thing, right? So,
yeah, high frequency HFT being high frequency trading, not to be confused with NFT, non-fungible token, not to be confused with NFP, non-farm payroll in the labor market. So it's a very complicated game, the game that you and I play, Weston. But just to go on the Bank of America's fund survey, which you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So last, for the month of April, they conducted this report and they interview all these fund managers, these investment managers, and they said, what do you think is the most crowded trade? And they said long technology. Now they said long technology. 27% of the people interviewed said that the most crowded trade is long Bitcoin. And this is not, this is not Bitcoin Twitter. This is institutional money managers.
Yeah, well, so this is 200 institutional, 200 buy side hedge funds and institutions. I think it's like 600 billion combined AUM. This, first of all, so this is actually a nice snapshot of where the institutional at least sentiment or what they say sits. So this was the first month since February 2020, since COVID, in which COVID was not the number one tail risk. The number one tail risk was inflation. Strange tail risk. Seems like a strange tail risk, because the tail risk implies that this is something that nobody would expect. And I would think that even people who are not even in the inflation camp, should inflation rear its ugly head, they're not going to be shocked and say like, what is this, like this CPI print, like this, I never occurred to me. Like, so it's kind of weird that was the number one. What's even weirder is the fact that top tail risk is inflation, 35%. Expectations for above trend growth and inflation are at all time record highs at 69%. So you have a simultaneous expectations for above trend inflation and the biggest tail risk being inflation. So it's kind of interesting to square those if you can.
Yeah, and what do you get when there's inflation? Well, there's increasing pressure on the Federal Reserve to raise rates. And what I found striking, Weston, is that last month in April, about 10% of fund managers expected that the Fed would raise interest rates in the first half of 2022, so relatively early. Now it's at 21%. So the number of fund managers who think that the Fed is basically, you know, calling the Fed's bluff and saying that the Fed is going to have to hike interest rates sooner than they are claiming, which would prick the stock market, not to mention the bond market, is rising. And that is a real threat to equity markets. So perhaps the weakness that we've seen in stocks is related to that. Weston, what I want to ask you about is the Federal Reserve and the tapering that they will do. So the Federal Reserve had their FOMC meeting today, and Tom has a question about this. They released their minutes today. They said, how do you think employment numbers and the Fed's thinking and tapering will have an impact on the crypto market? We'll get to that. But Weston, what I noticed in the FOMC minutes that were released today is that they noted that, quote, it might be appropriate at some point in upcoming meetings to begin discussing a plan for adjusting the pace of asset purchases. Asset purchases meaning QE all across the yield curve, not just at the absolute short end of the curve, which is the federal funds rate, essentially. So they're not thinking about raising rates or doing it. They are thinking about making a plan to taper asset purchases. And the guidance that they're giving is that they will completely stop QE 3 quarters after the first reduction in the first pace of asset purchases. And then the first increase in rates is 3 quarters after that. So really what they're saying is 6 quarters or 1.5 years between a tapering and a raising of a rate. And if you do the math, you realize that the Fed would have to started tapering months ago in order for them to have raised rates in the first half of 2022. So 21% of fund managers are not believing at all what the Federal Reserve said. Am I right or am I wrong?
No, that's apparently what that says, right? It's just so amusing. This is the last time I was on RBDV with you. I said the same thing. It's just very amusing that the front end of the rates market does not believe a word that the Fed says when they say we are leaving policy very accommodative. And we are going to, you know, one print does not make a trend in this and that, right? First of all, that fund manager, not the fund manager survey, the Fed minutes that came out today, that was pre that non-farm payrolls massive Wall Street embarrassment level miss, where there was like 1 million or something that came in at 200K. And that was also not including the CPI print that came out after the fact. So everything that you're, you know, talking about with whispers of potential talking about hiking sometime, you know, down the road, that was all before any of this. In which Powell was kind of vindicated when he was saying, look, it's one jobs number, let's wait to see what happens, and then you get 200K number. I think it's gonna be very interesting. Just like you said, the Fed has to, you know, you can't just start hiking rates out of nowhere. You have to like talk the market into it very, very slowly and all that. And I don't know how they have enough time to be able to do that. If inflation is not transitory, you only find out that it's not transitory after the fact. After it's been a long time and inflation is still here, that's when you realize it's not transitory. By then it's too late, right? So I don't know how they're gonna, it's gonna be super interesting, but.
Oh my God. Yeah. I command F searched the document, which I downloaded for the word transitory, and it appeared so many times. It was just like, that word was just whacking me in the face. But, Weston, I want to ask you about, they mentioned the Bank of Canada announced a reduction in their pace of asset purchases, and they noted that too. So is it kind of like if you have a lawn and you notice that your neighbor trimmed their lawn? And they're like, oh man, they turned their lawn. Maybe I should start getting on that too.
Well, from what I understand, what the Bank of Canada has done, they're not really like this pioneer, like hawk central bank that they might seem to be or they might claim to be. They were basically at this limit in which if they kept on buying as much debt as they were, they would basically be the Bank of Japan. And nobody wants to be the Bank of Japan, even though everyone will eventually be the Bank of Japan. as they always are. You know, Bank of Japan starts the policy, and then 8 to 10 years later, everyone else comes in. But yeah, they were basically about to like own the you know the Canadian bond market, and you don't want to be in the situation where you're Japan and you own 500 trillion yen or half quadrillion yen worth of outstanding debt, half the nation's debt, and just completely, you know, destroy the what used to be the second most liquid and active sovereign rates market in the world, just completely under state control. And by the way, Bank of Japan yield curve control, and I forgot to mention to you this the last time on RVDB, Bank of Japan instituting yield curve control means that there is yield curve control indirectly instituted on the Federal Reserve or on U.S. Treasuries, because the Bank of Japan, or because the Japanese investors are, Japan's the largest foreign creditor to the United States. Japan is a big buyer of U.S. Treasuries, and they do that because there is no yield at home, because Bank of Japan has artificially suppressed the yield curve and nailed and pinned the 10-year down to around zero. And that means they go overseas to the United States and they buy treasuries. That pulls down the yield curve, and therefore you have indirect yield curve control on the U.S. Treasury curve via the Bank of Japan.
Weston, I want to move on. Prius Omega says that the 10-year bond yield is up, gold flat. What's the relationship between bonds, gold, crypto, and equities? Western algos traders selling gold on the yield move up while foreigners dump bonds to buy gold or cover leveraged crypto bets. And this reminds me of, and I know I'm sorry, I'm just blasting you with words, but Mario G asked, did the Bitcoin sell-off contribute to the selling in equities and commodities today? So what do you make of the correlations between the assets? It's a famous line, Weston. We've all heard it. Bitcoin is uncorrelated to the equity market. There definitely was a time when that was true. Is it still true?
Okay. Uncorrelated in what way? If fundamentally uncorrelated, fine. Yeah. Bitcoin and the equity market, you know, Bitcoin is its own monetary system. Equities are pieces of paper that represent Apple and all that kind of thing. Not correlated in that sense. Are they price correlated? Which is what we care about, because we care. Do we care more about a story, or do we care about the mark-to-market value of our portfolios? Probably the latter.
Definitely.
Are they correlated in that sense on the short term? Absolutely they are. And they're only going to become more correlated as they become more and more adopted by institutions which hold the same assets. And for that matter, retail also is getting very heavily involved in equities and traditional assets as well, along with holding onto to crypto. So when you saw this massive futures sell coming in, Bitcoin futures coming in at like, you know, 9-ish, a little after 9 a.m. Eastern today, there's a reason that E-minis, you know, dipped right alongside, and that gold futures, you know, moved to the upside. These aren't happening by coincidence. You know, it's not like there's a sudden bid for gold because of for no reason. It's that, and that actually showed that indeed there might have been some of the gold weakness that's attributed to the fact that Bitcoin and crypto had been stealing some of that inflation hedge share away. And yeah, is it correlated to the S&P 500? The top of the S&P 500 ladder is essentially, well, first of all, you have Tesla that is long this asset, and then they're of course going to be correlated to, you know, the equity market if they're basically, you know, a tech heavy weighting, and then in addition to that, semiconductor index, there is a fundamental case for there too, right? You need semiconductor production and you need chips and all that in order to have crypto activity, whatever it may be. That, you know, a chip crunch is not really going to, you know, it's not going to not impact, right? And so yeah, you get, there's a fundamental and price correlation that very much exists. So when people say that it's not really correlated, Here's where I'll say that. Here's what I'll give you.
It's like, a 2018 talking point that was true then. It's just not now. If you look at the regressions, which I have, you correlate the daily returns. I mean, it's just obviously that they're. I mean,
yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
What I'll say is that the what I was saying before, what's not correlated is the fact that this is a free market, and so therefore you can have these minus 40% drops in the half an hour, the course of a day, and then have it rebound halfway back up. Even if it's down 10% for the day, you would never notice. Never, or if it's flat on the day, you never knew that it was down. That if imagine the Nasdaq fell 40% in that Dow flash crash from 2011 or whatever that was, and it came right back. That would never happen. The Nasdaq fell 40% in 10 minutes. The Powell will be out right now alongside Janet Yellen, basically hand in hand saying we got this, right? And still the markets will not believe them. This was a market capitulation,
sure,
a correction.
Sorry to interrupt, Wesson. But sure, but it's the Federal Reserve wouldn't immediately violate within that 10-minute sell-off. They wouldn't violate the Federal Reserve Act and start buying the Nasdaq themselves and put it on their balance sheet. I'd say that the support to the equity market from the Fed is indirectly through the money market, through the bond funds. And by the way, Weston, that helps Bitcoin too. So I don't know.
Here's what I'll say though. The Fed doesn't have, they don't have to explicitly say that. It's just implied. Everybody knows that there is a put. Who doesn't know that, right? That's why there's excessive risk taking, because you know that there's not gonna, that they cannot let the 77 million boomers with their 401ks who are about to hit retirement just get their assets sliced in half and just leave them there. No, so that's not gonna happen. So in order for that to not happen, those assets cannot go down. Credit spreads have to be narrow. Stock prices have to go forever upwards, and that's just the way things are. So, if crypto, falls, this is what I keep saying, that if it falls, it's going to the natural course of the markets are going to filter out what has a real value proposition. What's just been, kind of floating with the tide, and what is actually has staying power. So same thing as the dot-com crash. You have the survivors, the Amazons, the Yahoos, and all of them in the sea of rubble of whatever bullshit dot-coms that are, carcassed all over the place. So if you have a real value proposition in your coin, in your token, in your whatever it may be, there's no need to be, and I'm going to talk, take on the maximalists here. There is no need for you to be a fascist and go out and tell people what to and what not to buy. If you're that self-conscious about your product, I mean, that's the message that I get, right? If you are confident about your use case and all that, say, but go ahead, buy whatever shitcoin you want to, and you will come crawling back. That, to me, is, the best sort of sales pitch. But, let the free market decide. So again, I just keep coming back to this point, is that we had a very important lesson today that I don't want people to lose sight of, is that when, we had a plummet and we had markets correct, and even if they were down 50% and they stayed down today, that's still what a free market is behaving like. And that's okay. That's great. That's how equity should behave. That's how, high yield credit should behave. All of these artificially supported zombie assets and all that—they are not how markets behave. You got a taste of what markets are supposed to behave like today. It's like an experiment almost.
Weston. Yeah. So much there to analyze, and we're running out of time. But I just got to ask you a question. So you'd agree that Bitcoin is becoming increasingly correlated to traditional financial assets, such as, let's say, the S&P 500, right?
Sure.
Okay, and you would agree. Sorry to go all Socrates on you, but you would agree that there is a Fed put on the S&P 500 or on stocks, right?
I would.
So wouldn't that suggest that there is an emergent Fed put on Bitcoin indirectly, of course. Of course, the Fed does not want to do that, but it's just kind of a proxy.
There's even a Fed put in the sense that the more that the Fed has a put, the more supportive it is of, from an ideological standpoint, of Bitcoin. People are, the more that they print money to support assets, the more that people flock into Bitcoin. So in that sense, it's a reinforcing put, or it's a, you know, I mean, I don't know what you want to call it. It's a hedge out of it. It's whatever it is. But clearly there is a connection with the Federal Reserve. And it's not just the Fed. It's ECB, it's the BOJ, it's everyone's collective, you know, abuse of their printing press, if you will, and their long-term liabilities, and, you know, interest in other monetary systems. So that's... you call it a put, it's just a reaction function to me. Sure.
My final point, Weston, would be just explaining the correlation. I think it has to do with the wealth effect, which is when your asset goes up, you feel wealthier because you are. So let's say you own Bitcoin, and when it goes down, you feel poorer because, you know, you are on paper. And as the share of people who own Bitcoin also own stocks, that will compel them to sell their stocks as well. And right now, that's largely a psychological phenomenon, but it becomes formalized when hedge funds start buying crypto, and then crypto crashes, let's say, and suddenly, you know, their value at risk, that shoots up. So then they have to, get a contagion effect into other assets. The final point that I'll make, Weston, and I want to get your take on this, is, so in case we haven't, you know, angered the Bitcoin maximalists enough, I would say that the Bitcoin maximalists are correct in attacking the other coins, because they correctly identify the other coins as a threat. It's kind of like SPACs. Like, there's the first SPAC, let's say DraftKings, and it's a huge success. But then other coins, or other SPACs spin out, and suddenly there's a huge amount of supply on the market and not enough demand. We kind of seeing that with crypto. You know, I think Bitcoin and Ethereum and all the other coins that, you know, arguably have real value would be doing better if it weren't for the Dogecoins and the cum rockets of the world. I think the ire at Elon Musk for pumping Dogecoin and going out of Bitcoin is technically correct, I think. In terms of if they want to achieve their strategy of having Bitcoin succeed, I think they're right in that. I don't necessarily agree with them, but I don't know. Your closing thoughts, because we really run over.
Okay, I'm going to tie it into this catalyst that everyone's missing. Coinexchange.io. Does anyone remember what that is? If you don't know what that is the catalyst for the sell-off for today. It is not it is not China. It is not the PBOC. If your long case for Bitcoin was the PBOC was going to embrace it, you probably should have sold today. That is not why we sold off. Okay, so CoinExchange.io was some very shady exchange that existed back in the 2017 boom. They had a ton of these very weird, small, like, you know, you could call them shitcoins, call them whatever they want to, that were like, you know, like less than a penny. One of those was Dogecoin. They went bust, and they have a lot of customers who did not pull their assets out. They didn't notify that they were, you know, allowed to withdraw their assets. Dogecoin recently has gone up whatever tens of thousands of percent. And now suddenly they came out of nowhere on May 6th of this year. So just recently, saying that as of yesterday, they will be opening up the window of time in which customers can withdraw their coins and their assets from CoinExchange.io. And people who are sitting on, I don't know, tens of thousands or hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Dogecoin gains, they are now currently pulling them out. They have to the end of the month to do so. And my belief is that they will be pulling these assets out. They're going to have a mass liquidation of Dogecoin. That's going to lead to a mass liquidation of crypto. That was something that I flagged for the last, I don't know, week or so. And so I said, look out specifically for this day. This is basically what's been happening. So when it comes to things like correlation and all that kind of thing, the reason that Dogecoin matters for Bitcoin is because this is an iteration of an idea from Chris Cole, the volatility trader, who said that, you know, it's possible that Bitcoin, you know, why do central banks allow Bitcoin, you know, globally to exist? And why do they allow for this whole ecosystem to exist and the speculation and all that? And it could be because they need to implement, you know, easy monetary policy. One of the negative side effects, the inevitable negative side effects of easy monetary policy is asset price inflation. So what this this crypto space does is it allows for $1 or $2 trillion of that excess froth to be diverted away from stocks and from real estate and all that, and to go into this very benign asset. That's what I believe the role that Dogecoin plays for Bitcoin. Completely accidentally, completely unknowingly, but that's basically taking the excess froth out of Bitcoin, which helps people in the actual DeFi world and the serious people who want to be taken seriously, who want to have credibility with Bitcoin and all that. But when you have Dogecoin that is at $30 billion in AUM or in market cap, when that gets liquidated, you're going to see mass liquidations across the board, which is exactly what has been happening today. That was a catalyst for today. Not China, not the PBOC.
But I said, you can read the note on the exchange. That is a phenomenal, phenomenal idea. I wish I could continue to analyze that with you. We could go on for hours, but I, you know, if we do, I'll be further in the doghouse with my producer than I already am. So we'll have to leave it there. You guys, if you like Weston's work, definitely check him out on the exchange, realvision.com/exchange, right?
Exchange.realvision.com.
There we go. Exchange.realvision.com. And if you're watching this on realvision.com, thank you so much for being a member. If you're watching this on YouTube, I'm glad you watched it. But if you really want to get to where the real action is, go to realvision.com. By the way, a final plug to end our exponential age exploration that we've been doing over the past 2 weeks. Ral is going to be having a conversation with a Real Vision fan favorite and former hedge fund manager, macro iconoclast, Hugh Hendry. So that is going to be streamed live at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, I believe, on Friday. And all members on realvision.com will be able to view it. And if you want to watch it and you're not a member, you can sign up for $1 to get a 2-week trial, and you'll be able to view that wrap-up video. I've been corresponding with Hugh all this week, and I've been sending him Ral's thoughts, and I think there's a lot of stuff percolating there, so I think that's going to be a really exciting talk. So thank you so much, Weston, for joining us, joining me, and thank you to everyone at home. We'll see you tomorrow.